From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is Trump trying to sink both Obamacare and the Iran deal? I'm Jamil Smith, in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. President Trump on Thursday took not one but two dramatic actions to weaken the Affordable Care Act. First, an executive order to expand cheap, less robust insurance. Then, late last night, he declared the government will no longer pay some $7 billion in subsidies that help people with lower incomes purchase health insurance. What's it all mean for the future of Obamacare? And on foreign policy, today Trump is announcing that he'll disavow the landmark nuclear deal that the Obama administration helped strike with Iran. Not scrapping it exactly, but kicking the responsibility for what happens next to Congress. Two campaign promises, two ways to erase the Obama legacy at home and abroad. Stay with us. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Jamil Smith, in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. President Trump is trying to make good this week on two campaign promises that upend the legacies of his predecessor, Barack Obama. Later in the show, we'll look at Trump's disavowal of the Iran nuclear deal today, kicking the matter to Congress. Is it a real foreign policy reversal or more of a political compromise? We'll look at that. But first, on the domestic front, the Republican Party has failed several times to repeal and replace Obamacare. So President Trump has taken the matters into his own hands as much as he can. He hit the Affordable Care Act twice yesterday. First, an executive order that expanded cheap but flimsy insurance policies. Then, close to midnight, a declaration that he's ending the scheduled payments to health insurance providers that help cover lower-income Americans. Joining me now to talk about this is Margo Sanger-Katz, who covers health care for The Upshot at The New York Times. Thanks for joining us on To the Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Margo, the announcement last night that he's ending $7 billion in subsidies put cost-sharing reduction subsidies into the political lexicon, CSRs. What are CSRs and how big a deal is this?
So this is an unfortunately complicated but important thing that happened. Obamacare was set up so that when low-income people buy insurance products, they don't have to pay the same high deductibles that people who earn more money pay, because the assumption is they can't afford it. So what the law said is that insurance companies should give discounts on their deductibles and copayments to customers who earn below 250% of the federal poverty level. That's like around $30,000 for a single person. And that the federal government should reimburse the insurance companies for the amount that they are discounting. And it turned out in the drafting of the Affordable Care Act that there was some unclear language, and it was not totally clear that that money, while it was authorized and that chain is clear, that it was not clear that it was appropriated. Mm-hmm. And so that has allowed the president to say that it is unlawful for the executive branch to continue to make those payments. So what that means is that those checks that had been going out to insurers every month will stop for November and December of this year and presumably into the foreseeable future. People who are getting these subsidies will continue to get them. The insurance companies do not have the ability to take them away. So if you're someone who is having your deductible lowered by one of these subsidies, you don't need to worry about this right away. But it is a big financial hit to these insurance companies that had come to rely on this money. And I think it could create a high degree of turmoil as they reconsider whether or not they want to continue to sell Obamacare insurance next year and the year afterwards when this money that they had counted on is sort of precipitously taken away.
Now, you mentioned the legality of this. Are states going to sue the government over this? And if so, which ones?
It does appear that way. There's been a longstanding lawsuit about this issue. It's actually between the Congress and the executive branch. The House of Representatives sued the Obama administration, which first started paying these subsidies when they were running the government. And a group of 18 states has intervened in that lawsuit and said, we also think, along with the Obama administration, that these subsidies should be continued to be paid. And there are some rumblings now that the states might file a separate lawsuit trying to block Trump from stopping the payments. So there's a lot of litigation, and it may be that health insurers will also sue and say, no, under law, we are entitled to this money, and the federal government might, if they lose that lawsuit, have to pay them back.
So why do this now? I mean, open enrollment is, what, November 1st, right, for Obamacare. Is that the reason why they're doing this now?
I don't have any particular insight into this timing, to be perfectly honest. The president, almost from the moment he took office, has been threatening to take this money away. I think he was briefed on it early, and he understood that it was something that was within his power and that could be disruptive to the Obamacare marketplaces. The one thing that I will say is that yesterday, the president also unveiled an executive order which directed agencies to do various things to change the nature of health insurance in the country. And so it's possible that they, as an administration, just made a decision that they wanted to tear down as much of Obamacare as they could possibly do under existing law, and this is part of that strategy. It may also be that, you know, it was just getting close to the last minute to really make this decision, and they decided that they wanted to finally pull the trigger, but I don't know.
So which of those two actions do you feel like could be most disruptive, both short-term and long-term?
It's a little bit hard to assess. So the thing about the executive order is it doesn't actually do anything. It just says to these various cabinet agencies, please look into these issues and see if there's a way that you can change regulations to achieve various goals. And we don't really know what the answer to those questions is going to be. We have some ideas based on what the executive order says. I would say the most consequential thing that could happen is that insurance companies may be able to start offering what are known as short-term health insurance plans. So these are plans that are designed for people maybe who are between jobs for a few months or have some other gap in coverage. They are not subject to the same kinds of regulations as other types of health insurance. So they can deny you coverage if you've been sick in the past. They may not cover prescription drugs or other kinds of benefits. And the Trump administration wants to expand those to make them last longer so they're more like a full-year policy and to allow them to be marketed more broadly. So it's possible that more people could end up in these kind of flimsier insurance plans, and that could hurt the Obamacare marketplace by drawing healthier people who might have otherwise bought more comprehensive coverage out.
Well, I'm speaking with Margo Sanger-Katz from the New York Times. We're going to take a brief break. We're going to continue this conversation with her and others on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Hello again. I'm Jamil Smith, in for Warren Olney. This is To the Point. We're talking about the double whammy announcement yesterday from the Trump administration on its new approach to the Affordable Care Act. Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He also writes the Economy Hub blog at the paper. Michael, welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So, Michael, what did these twin blows to Obamacare accomplish in your view, and have any laws actually changed?
Certainly what's changed, as Margo was just saying a few minutes ago, is the payment of the cost-sharing reductions to insurance companies. And I would point out that this is a change that probably doesn't bother insurance companies for 2018 that much, because a lot of them have priced the loss of these reductions into their premiums for next year. And California and many other states allowed them to do that, anticipating a move like this. But the Trump administration actually chose the worst time to do this, because it's cutting these reduction payments off in mid-year, which means, as Margo said, a lot of the insurance companies are going to take a big financial hit this year, and a lot of them actually have the contractual right under their arrangements with the federal government to terminate their insurance policies instantly if the CSR payments are not made. And that means that millions of Americans could lose their insurance within the next few weeks. So that's an immediate change in the law with an immediate effect. As Margo said, the executive order is sort of a long-term thing. It calls on these agencies, HHS, Treasury, Labor, to start looking at ways that they might change laws and regulations. But some of those changes are going to require new statutes. Some of them are going to require a lot of administrative work, hearings, comment periods. It's certainly true they're not going to be able to be done for the 2018 insurance year. It's going to be very ambitious to see if they can do it for 2019. But overall, the signal that this issues is that the Trump administration really is determined to undermine the Affordable Care Act every way it can, and that's not going to be a happy place for insurance companies.
Stephen Dennis covers the Senate for Bloomberg. Welcome, Stephen.
It's great to be here.
So, Stephen, first things first, Donald Trump tweeted this morning, quote, "The Democrats' Obamacare is imploding. Massive subsidy payments to their pet insurance companies has stopped. Dems should call me to fix!" Exclamation point. It sounds a little bit like a protection racket. You know, it just sounds a little bit like he's damaging something and hoping that they'll come to the table to repair it. Can you tell us how Democrats are reacting to this news?
Well, they're accusing him of trying to sabotage the markets. But, you know, Trump is, you know, he just said, to reporters that it would be nice if the Democratic leaders would come over to the White House, and if they came over, maybe we could make a deal. And clearly what he is looking at this situation as leverage. You know, he's been very frustrated in the inability to get Republicans to pass his plan by the narrowest of margins, and he's looking for other options. And to bring Democrats to the table, he's looking at the CSR payments here now as leverage to get them to that table and for some concessions. And, you know, exactly what those concessions might be, we don't know. You know, we know that the president wants wall funding. He also wants more flexibility for states. So far, you know, the bipartisan negotiations in the Senate between the health chairman, Lamar Alexander, and Patty Murray of Washington have yet to produce an actual bill to get to the Senate floor. And even if it did get an agreement between the two of them, that's not nearly enough. Mm. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, isn't interested in pursuing a fix for the system. They want to blow it up. So somewhere between a fix and blowing it up might be a solution, but, you know, it's not obvious that this is something that's been sort of circling this whole issue for the past year. And I do think December is sort of the time frame for getting something done. I don't see some magical quick fix, you know, sort of showing up in the next couple of weeks, barring some calamity. I think you start looking at December. That's when the funding for the government expires. That's when Trump needs Democratic votes to keep the government open. And that's when Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have the most leverage. So this could wind up in one big, giant Christmas Eve kind of deal where the president is looking for some Christmas ornaments and the Democrats want things like CSR payments and protection for the DACA kids, the 800,000 people who got deferred deportation. Right. You could start seeing this tied up with a bunch of other things in a bow in December.
So, Margo, though, I mean, he's expecting Christmas presents, but it could be coal in the stocking, could be a government shutdown in December if the Democrats don't go along with this. Does the president actually have the leverage here?
I think it's very hard to assess, in part because the insurers don't really have until December to decide whether or not they're going to offer insurance to Obamacare customers next year. People start signing up for these plans on November 1st. And so I think most of the decisions by insurers are going to happen sooner than that. And if we end up in a situation where, for example, there's a place in the country where there are no insurers offering any kind of coverage, that's going to be a pretty terrible emergency that is not going to be easily fixed in December. I think also, you know, it's not clear if the president is going to be able to make a deal on this thing because he hasn't really said for sure what it is that he wants in exchange. On health care, he has supported a number of different Republican repeal bills that would be unacceptable to most Democrats, of course. It's possible, you know, as Steve said, that maybe he would want to trade this for something not related to health care. I think we need a little bit more time to figure out what that sort of deal looks like. My guess is for this to really help the markets, there would need to be a pretty firm deal relatively soon.
I want to take it a little bit back to the ground, Margo, and ask you, what kind of consumer is most likely to be hurt by all this in the most immediate future?
So I've been hearing from a lot of consumers who are really worried about this, and I think what you need to understand is if you are someone who's getting these subsidies right now, don't get scared yet. The insurance companies are going to keep offering you the plan with the current financial arrangement that you have right now. There are two sets of risks. One is that insurance companies will just say, you know what, forget it. I don't want to participate in this market anymore. The Trump administration keeps throwing these curveballs at me. They're taking money out of my pocket. This is not a good business opportunity. And that could mean that consumers might have to switch to a different health plan next year, or perhaps they would live in a place where there are no options. So that is a bad outcome. And then the other thing is that because insurers have sort of known that this might come, many of them have asked to increase the price for insurance next year by really substantial margins, you know, in some places 20, 30, 50% increases over this year's price. And so if you're someone who is not receiving a government subsidy and you have to pay the full price of your insurance out of your pocket, that's a big hit to have to pay a 50% increase due to this policy uncertainty. So those people may continue to have insurance options, but they might be too expensive for them to afford.
Thank you, Margo Sanger-Katz from The Upshot at The New York Times. Really appreciate you joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Steven, I want to go back to you on this, and Michael. First, Michael, I just want to ask you a little bit about the continuing about the Democratic reaction. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, tweeted this morning that, quote, Trump's decision to stop ACA payments is nuclear-grade bananas, a temper tantrum that sets the entire health system on fire. My God. Michael, I want to ask you, can Democrats successfully pin this on President Trump, or are consumers simply going to say Obamacare is failing? I'm going to associate that with Barack Obama.
Consumers and voters actually have identified the problems with Obamacare this year with the Republicans and with Trump. And I think these actions yesterday, the executive order combined with the cancellation of the cost-sharing reduction payments, really does make this Trump care now. It's going to be very, very difficult for President Trump and Republicans in Congress to say this was baked in to Obamacare, although we already are hearing conservatives say that. But it's clear that the immediate problems that we're going to see in the Obamacare markets really do trace to these actions, as well as earlier actions that the administration has taken, that is to cut back on marketing of Obamacare plans, to shrink the open enrollment period in half from 3 months to 6 weeks, combined with the lack of any outreach and any marketing, that's going to be a real problem. And I don't think it's going to be that hard to really point at all of these actions that Trump has taken and say this is really what's creating the problem with Obamacare.
Same question to you, Stephen. What, you know, political blame game that Washington loves to play it, but no one's going to want to take credit for, you know, what's about to happen to these health markets, it looks like. What do you think is going to happen, especially as we start ramping up towards 2018?
Well, certainly, you know, in conversations with Republican senators in the hallway here in recent weeks, this action is not suddenly a shock, right? There have been lots of talk of doing this sort of thing and the potential hit on markets, and most Republican senators have shrugged it off, saying, "Hey, this is Obama's plan. I never voted for it. That's why, you know." And they're blaming Obama. It's a pretty easy thing for them to do. Most of them are not up for re-election here in the Senate. And so it's not clear how they're going to view it. The one thing to keep in mind is the administration, a lot of Republican senators, have not given up the dream of passing a repeal and replace bill next year. The last bill failed, never got an actual vote after Susan Collins, Rand Paul, and John McCain killed it. But there's a lot of talk of trying again in the spring. Once tax reform is over and done with one way or the other, they could come back and try to do another budget resolution and another reconciliation package and try to get one of those three people on board. And suddenly you have the Republican dream back on the table. And the motivation for passing something goes up if the system is collapsing, right? So Rahm Emanuel used to like to say, you know, never waste a crisis. Well, if you Washington tends to move faster if there is a crisis. So whether it's a crisis of Trump's making or Obama's making, if there's a crisis, it's easier to get senators to vote for things. So if you have a situation where there are bare counties, if you have a situation where the premiums have soared 30%, you can present your plan as the solution to the crisis, whether you helped create it or not. And that's something to keep in mind as well. What is the situation going to look like next June, next July, if Republicans are trying again to pass some overarching repeal and replace bill? And what do people like John McCain and Rand Paul and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, how do they approach it next year? So, you know, this leverage right now is about getting Democrats to the table. But if you continue to see degraded markets and lackluster efforts to support those markets from the Trump administration, or even to undermine them, you could see pressure on Republicans to come to the table who previously sort of stood in the way.
Michael, is this about erasing President Obama's legacy? Is that pretty much it, or is this just, you know, fulfilling campaign promises to do exactly that?
Well, to a certain extent, you're asking a metaphysical question, and you're asking me to look into the mind and soul of President Donald Trump, and that's sort of a murky place.
Fair enough.
I think everything he has said about the Affordable Care Act, whether he's tweeted it or said it outright, demonstrates, first of all, that he's got some sort of personal thing going on with President Obama, and he sees this. We all talk about Obamacare being Obama's real legacy. He sees this as a way to get at his predecessor. At the same time, it's evident almost with everything he says that he doesn't understand health care. He doesn't understand the health care system we have. And he's sort of flailing about with all of these measures at attacking it piecemeal without really understanding that this is a system with almost infinite moving parts. And if you pull on one thread, you can unravel a lot of other seams. And that's really what's happening. So there's this sort of overarching feeling that he's being petulant and truculent about it without really thinking things through. And that's why all of the measures he's taken, none of them really go to improving the healthcare delivery system of the United States for the Americans who were affected in the individual and small business market. Mm-hmm. They're all aimed at something else, and I think we see the same these same shortcomings in the Republican congressional approach to the ACA. I mean, if you were really looking to improve the healthcare system in the United States, you would never have come up with some of these repeal bills mm-hmm. that they've been trying to pass in the last few months.
Thanks to our guests, Margo Sanger-Katz from The Upshot at The New York Times, Michael Hiltzik from The Los Angeles Times, and Stephen Dennis at Bloomberg News. Thank you very much. We'll take a brief break, and then we'll turn to the president's comments today on dealing with Iran. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Jamil Smith back with To the Point. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about two decisions from the Trump White House that could upend Obama-era policies. And now we're going to turn to the Iran nuclear deal. In 2015, the Obama administration struck a landmark deal with Iran and other world powers to curtail the Iranian nuclear program. From the campaign trail, then-candidate Donald Trump called it a bad deal. Probably the worst deal. He still does. However, as part of the agreement, the president has to certify every 90 days whether Iran is complying, and so far he's done just that. But today, Trump went further.
While the United States adheres to our commitment under the deal, the Iranian regime continues to fuel conflict, terror, and turmoil throughout the Middle East and beyond. Importantly, Iran is not living up to the spirit of the deal.
So he's not scrapping it exactly, but he's kicking the responsibility for what happens next to Congress, where Republicans who would prefer to focus on their tax reform effort are reportedly unlikely to invalidate the agreement by imposing sanctions. Laura Rosen is a correspondent for Al Monitor, an online news outlet focused on the Middle East. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you, Jamil.
So Trump has decertified the nuclear deal. What does that mean exactly? And is this something that's under U.S. law, or is it something else?
Yeah, you got it exactly right, that he actually withheld certification to Congress about a U.S. law that provides oversight of the deal reached in 2015. As you mentioned, he has to certify every 90 days that Iran's in compliance with this deal. The International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna has inspectors in Iran, and they've been reporting every quarter, eight times now, that Iran is fulfilling the deal. And so Trump tried to kind of split the difference by saying, well, they're technically complying with the nuclear deal, but there's a line in the preamble of the agreement that says the agreement should, you know, advance regional peace and security. And so all of this other behavior he doesn't like from Iran, he says, means Iran is not living up to the spirit of the deal.
It seems like pretty much everyone but President Trump believes that Iran is actually in compliance, though. It seems that's right.
And even the U.S., in fact, even his own advisors, Secretary Tillerson and Secretary of Defense Mattis, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Dunford, have all testified that not only is Iran complying, but they think that staying in the agreement is in the U.S. national interest.
So what is this about? Is this just about Trump appearing pugnacious? Is it just wanting to pick a fight?
I think he's talked publicly about just it driving him crazy to have to certify Obama's deal every quarter to Congress. And you know, he clearly doesn't like Iran's behavior. And even though, you know, and he thinks that he could have negotiated a far better deal and that that his predecessor was weak on Iran and that he wants to be much tougher. What is interesting to me is that, you know, he talked today about, like, this is not just about the nuclear deal. He wants to have a strategy that addresses a broad range of Iranian behavior. But there were pretty few specifics about what is he actually going to do to counter that behavior. He says that he wants to, you know, stop. So, you know, there's a limited amount of tools. You know, for instance, the Iran support for Shia militia groups in the region. When push comes to shove and the U.S. and Iranian-backed groups have run into skirmishes in Syria, Trump has told his advisors, back out. He doesn't want to have a war with Iran in Syria. Mm. So it's interesting that he's sort of attacking the one part of this very troubled relationship between the U.S. and Iran that seemed to be working.
How painstaking was it to cut this international deal in the first place? I mean, I know there's probably a lot of diplomatic dancing.
It was 13 years of negotiations. I mean,
wow.
The U.S. didn't get involved until about 2012. And then when Rouhani came into power, the more pragmatic guy in Iran, in 2013, you know, they got an interim deal pretty quickly. And then it took three more years to get this comprehensive deal. And, you know, it was, you know, months and months and months and in Vienna and Geneva and Oman and other places. So this was not this 160-page agreement that has, like, how many specific centrifuges they can have at, you know, which place. And so, you know, this was not a casual agreement made on a cocktail napkin or something.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So, Laura, one last quick question. I just want to understand a little bit more about what Trump's end game is here. Not just, you know, what is he hoping to accomplish by erasing Obama's legacy necessarily, but what is missing from the agreement that he feels like so urgently should be in it?
So what Secretary Tillerson briefed us last night and said that they want to go to Congress now and have Congress amend this legislation under which Trump previously had to report to them every quarter, and instead have Congress amend that legislation so he doesn't have to report, and also to try to fix things like that Iran, after 10, 15 years, can expand the number of centrifuges it has. They call that sunsets. He wants to have essentially the U.S. unilaterally make a law that says it's going to sanction Iran if they do that in 10 years, and also to sanction Iran's ballistic missile program, which the U.S. already was doing.
Laura Rosen, correspondent for Al Monitor, thank you for helping us to better understand this.
Thanks so much.
Next, I'll bring in Jonathan Schanzer, the Vice President for Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a think tank that has been a vocal opponent of the deal. He was formerly a terror finance analyst at the U.S. Treasury during the George W. Bush administration. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi there.
So, Jonathan, what does President Trump's decertification of the deal accomplish in your view?
What it effectively does is it plunges all of the actors into a period of uncertainty. The president is not scrapping the deal. He's not tearing it up, as I think he had threatened to do on the campaign trail and even from the White House. What he's basically saying is he doesn't think that the deal is working because of the sunset provisions that Laura mentioned, and those are significant, that Iran basically in a decade or so is going to be able to go nuclear according to the deal. There are other things that are set to expire, weapons, ballistic missiles, and the like. Meanwhile, we see Iran expanding its aggressive behavior across the Middle East, filling the void in Syria, slowly usurping Iraq. And so what the president's done is he said, okay, I want Congress to look at this. I want Congress to go and address this, which is built into the agreement that every 30 days, or 90 days rather, he has the ability, if he wishes to kick this to Congress. But more importantly, he's signaling to our European partners, to the Chinese and the Russians, those who were part of the original negotiation, that he's unsatisfied, and he is prompting them now to rethink their equities and perhaps to come up with some kind of a bridge. Mm-hmm. Between where he is and where they once were.
Let's bring in Kelsey Davenport, Director for Nonproliferation Policy at the Nonprofit Arms Control Association. Hello, Kelsey.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Kelsey, how does Iran go about complying with the deal? How do they actually do it? What are the steps that it takes?
Well, Iran took a number of steps once the deal was finalized in order to come under the limits imposed by the deal. And that's verified on a regular basis by International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors. They're on the ground. They have access on a regular basis to all of Iran's nuclear facilities. And they can visit undeclared facilities if they have concerns about illicit activities. And it's not just inspectors that are saying Iran is meeting its commitments. Several top U.S. generals have said U.S. intelligence points to the fact that Iran is abiding by the deal. So there's no question there that Iran is living up to its commitments. And that's why this approach that President Trump is pursuing is so dangerous and reckless. He's trying to get Congress to legislate extensions to limits that expire on the deal unilaterally. That's not only a slap in the face to U.S. partners and allies who have opposed this approach, but it undermines and potentially violates the deal. And that's not in a place that the U.S. should be, given that the deal is verifiably blocking Iran's pathways to nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, what I want to ask both of you, I mean, to what extent do you know, was Iran really making progress on developing nuclear weapons? I'll ask you first, Jonathan, then Kelsey.
Sure. I mean, what we know is that the Iranians were within less than a year of being able to break out, and that was one of the reasons why there was such an urgent push on the part of the Obama administration and its partners. And I think it actually was one of the reasons why we began to lose leverage in dealing with the Iranians at the time. We left everything else off the table. In other words, we decided not to address any of the regional activities that Iran's involved in, the support for terrorism, and we yielded on things like ballistic missiles, which, of course, are the delivery system for the nukes. Since that time, we've seen Iran continue to test ballistic missiles, which has caused a lot of concern. There are questions about gaining access to military sites where nuclear activity may be taking place. And this is, I think, the subject of an interesting debate that has yet, I think, to really yield any definitive answers. But this is not, I think, at this point, if I heard the president correctly today, this is not a nuclear issue entirely. This is about the rolling out of an Iran policy that his administration is going to follow, and that the nuclear issue, if I heard him correctly, was one of only four prongs. He was looking at ballistic missiles, terrorism, the IRGC, which figures to play a significant role, the Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran, which is the primary sowers of terrorism across the Middle East. And then the fourth prong was the nuclear one.
Kelsey, I want to ask what you heard from the president's speech, in you know, not just in terms of content, but also in terms of tone.
Well, I certainly agree that Iran is involved in a number of malign activities that are destabilizing to the region. But every problem that the United States has with Iran becomes more and more complicated if Iran has an unrestrained nuclear program. And again, that's why threatening an agreement that's working is such a problem. And that's why I think that President Trump's course of action by trying to change the terms of the deal isn't the best approach if he's worried about what happens down the road in 10 to 15 years, or if he actually wants to resolve Iran's support for terrorism or their troubling ballistic missile activities. If the United States sustains the deal at hand, demonstrates to Iran and the international community that Washington can be a good faith partner in an agreement, that creates opportunities to build on this deal. But destroying it only undermines U.S. credibility, and that's the course that Trump is headed down if he tries to push Congress to pass this legislation that rewrites the terms of the accord.
Let me bring in a third panelist here. Ariane Tabatabai is a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center and a columnist at the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Welcome, Ariane.
Thanks for having me.
What did you make of Trump's lengthy listing of the fraught history, specifically between the United States and Iran today, in his remarks? How might any of that relate to the present Iran deal?
Well, what I heard was a list of things that Iran is doing wrong, and many of those things are right, though I'm not convinced that every single item that was on the president's shopping list was exactly right and nuanced. That said, my problem with his general approach is that there is a lot of sticks and there seem to be no carrots involved. And I'm not sure that this is a policy that works. At the end of the day, there doesn't seem to be a concrete and viable option for moving forward on all of those different areas, or those different grievances and challenges that Iran poses to its neighborhood and to the United States. And I think that's deeply problematic. If you're going to remove the nuclear deal, if you're going to decertify the nuclear deal and kick it over to Congress to see what happens to its fate, then you better have a really tight plan. And I'm not sure then that the president really does.
Now, Jonathan, you know, David Frum is, you know, among other, you know, conservative writers who are critical of the president. And he wrote today that this is actually would be a smart move, but he can't trust that the president will actually execute any of this competently. How much does the president's credibility factor into this strategy?
Well, I think it's a huge question. My sense here is that the president's instincts on Iran are correct, that he sees the malign behavior that we've all discussed. He's seen the support for terrorism. He's seen the amount of money that we have provided the Iranians as a result of the deal, and he doesn't see that we've gotten enough in return. And I think those are all very valid concerns. But I think the real question is execution after this. So he's, as I mentioned, he's plunged everybody into a period of uncertainty. He's not walked away from the deal. He's not torpedoing the deal, but he's put on the table the option that it could be abrogated, that he could walk away from the deal. If this does not play out the way that he hopes, that the Europeans and Congress and others are able to go back and fix certain fatal flaws within the deal, then that begs the question, what happens next? And we didn't hear that today. And that is, I think, really what we all need to be watching, which is, I mean, we have 60 days now for Congress and others to wrestle with how to improve the deal. It's important that we give as much support as possible during that time. If the Iranians fail to deliver, or if the Europeans or the Chinese or the Russians, for that matter, fail to deliver, then we're into another dimension, one that I don't think we heard anything about today, and it will be critical for this administration to have a plan. I'd like to hear it.
Kelsey, I would like your take on that.
You know, I disagree about what we heard today. I think Trump was very clear that if he did not see the fixes that he wanted through U.S. legislation, that he would terminate the deal. Now, the head of the European Union's foreign policy team, Federica Mogherini, who loosely leads the coalition of countries that negotiated with Iran, you know, pushed back against that. She said it's not Trump's place to say that he can terminate the agreement. But certainly Trump could make implementation of the deal much more difficult if he tried to do that, if he withdrew from the deal and reimposed sanctions. Not only would that violate the deal, but it could hamper legitimate business with Iran that's allowed under the JCPOA. So I think that the future strategy is quite alarming. But again, I think it's just important to get back to this fundamental point that Trump is trying to unilaterally change the terms of the agreement. Yes, some provisions on the deal do expire in 10 to 15 years. Yes, there are legitimate concerns about where Iran's nuclear program might go at that point. But the best way to fix that is to look at it multilaterally, to demonstrate to Iran that another agreement, a follow-on agreement, could be reached. But to do that, we first have to sustain this deal. And that's not what the international community is hearing from President Trump right now. Trump is demonstrating that the United States is going to take a unilateral approach to change the goalposts on the agreement, and that shouldn't be acceptable.
Ariane, I want to ask you quickly before the break, how is Iran going to react to this, do you think?
Well, I mean, as we speak, the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, is actually offering some comments on Iranian state TV. And so far, what we've gathered from the various statements that have been made in Iran is that if the European Union, along with China and Russia, the two other parties to the nuclear deal, continue to implement the nuclear deal, that Iran would continue to uphold its end of the bargain, even if the United States leaves. I think that Kelsey is exactly right in that there is going to be a challenge stemming from the United States, from President Trump decertifying the nuclear deal, regardless of where we go next, because he's rocking the boat. And part of what Iran signed up for in coming to the table was to get the economic dividends from making concessions on its nuclear program. And if investors and businesses don't go into Iran because of the uncertainty, because of pending sanctions, because of the general strategy that seems to be emerging from the Trump administration, then Iran won't really have an incentive to stick around for too long. But I think for the foreseeable future, they are actually in pretty good shape, because what they can do and what they've already started doing is pointing at the U.S. and saying, look, we're the good guys here. We are implementing our end of the deal. And the United States is unilaterally rocking the boat when there is nothing really going on. There's nothing to see.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. I want to ask you afterwards a little bit more about what ordinary Iranians are thinking. What should you guys hold your thoughts? We're going to be right back. Again, with our guests talking about the Iran nuclear deal and President Trump's actions today, this is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Jamil Smith in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. I want to pick up where we left off before the break with Jonathan Schanzer, Kelsey Davenport, and Ariane Tabatabai. Ariane, can you tell me a little bit about what ordinary Iranians are thinking, especially given how, moderate we keep hearing that, the populace is shifting?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I think that President Obama had managed to really conduct a PR campaign that appealed to a large segment of the Iranian population. And I think President Trump has taken quite a few steps back, starting already with the big, you know, on the campaign trail with his rhetoric about Iran. Later on, going to Riyadh, where him and his team made quite a few comments about Iran, which were quite belligerent. And then today, where you know, he on the one hand was trying to appeal to the broader Iranian population, saying, "Look, our problem is not with you; our problem is with your regime." But then, on the other hand, also very much upping the ante and also calling the Persian Gulf the Arabian Gulf, which is a huge sore spot for Iranians. And so I think that the president is really reinforcing the view that the Islamic Republic had tried to install in the population and had failed, frankly, for nearly 40 years at this point, that the U.S. can't be trusted, that Iran needs to be self-reliant, that it needs to be ready for defense, and that the United States ultimately wants to topple the Iranian regime. And I think that President Trump is essentially hitting all these nails on the head and communicating to the broader Iranian population that the U.S. is not going to be on their side.
Jonathan, do you see this shift in policy as a potential way to counter Iran's growing influence in the region?
Well, I think that is the intent of this administration, that they certainly want to try to put more pressure on the Iranians. That the I think the perception has been, and not just only in the Trump White House, but certainly when you talk to our Sunni Arab allies, when you talk to the Israelis, their assessment is that during the Obama years, that the decision to not press them on these issues significantly while negotiating with them on the nuclear deal, providing more than $100 billion in sanctions relief, that all of this gave the Iranians the idea that they could somehow continue with this regional activity. In fact, when you look at the nuclear deal itself, it really doesn't address terrorism. It doesn't address cyber activity. It doesn't address human rights. All of the issues that I think are so important to understanding the problems that we have today with the Islamic Republic. And so this appears to be a U-turn on the part of this administration. Again, I think I need to point out that the decertification is what it's really done is it's kicked off a bureaucratic debate. No one's walking away from the deal right now. The big news out of the announcement today at the White House was that there is now a four-pronged strategy in dealing with Iran after a six-month review carried out by the White House and all the principals, where they want to push back on terror finance, on the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, on all the destabilizing activities that we're seeing across the Middle East. This appears to be the primary goal, while probably, I mean, from all intents, from what we can tell, they want to try to keep the nuclear deal and just fix aspects of it, which, I mean, when you look at all of it, the list, the nuclear issue was fourth on the president's list. He put these other issues further up in terms of priorities.
Kelsey, I do have the feeling, not to be cynical, that at the next rally we see President Trump at, he's going to claim left and right that he did walk away from this deal, and people will believe it. How much does, you know, whatever he, you know, he says about it matter? You know, does it matter more than that, what he actually ends up doing with it?
I absolutely think that Trump's rhetoric surrounding the deal is important. You know, Trump has said time and time again that Iran is violating the spirit of the agreement. There is no spirit of the agreement. That term does not have any legal meaning. And as troubling as some of Iran's activities outside of the deal might be, Iran has stuck to all of its commitments under the accord. That's been verified time and time again by international inspectors. But if Trump continues to say spirit of the deal, he'll continue to give the impression that Iran was in violation when that's not the case. And I'm concerned now that Trump is going to embark on an aggressive campaign that says he's fixing the deal. And I think that's problematic for several reasons. First, it encourages this idea that the United States can unilaterally change multilateral agreements at the congressional level. And that's a problem. It's not for the United States to come back and try and change these accords unilaterally when Washington has agreed to implement them.
Mm-hmm.
Second, I'm just concerned about what this will do for the future of the agreement. You know, there are important provisions in this deal that do not expire, that continue in perpetuity, that will give inspectors more insights into Iran's nuclear activities and will prohibit Iran from taking certain steps that would help it develop a nuclear weapon. If we lose the deal, we lose these permanent provisions, and that's certainly alarming.
Ariane, speaking of semantics, the new sanctions on Iran's Revolutionary Guard, I think a lot of people might hear the word sanctions and worry that that actually will invalidate the deal. What are the consequences of that particular move?
Well, so as far as we have seen so far anyway, you know, there was this idea that the president was going to designate the IRGC as a terrorist organization, which was going to have huge implications because of the fact that the IRGC, that's the Revolutionary Guards, they're an integral part of the Iranian armed forces at this point. We may not like what they do. They undertake a lot of nefarious activities, but they are considered a part of the Iranian armed forces. That said, what we heard from President Trump today seems to indicate that that is not going to be the case. He's just going to be imposing more sanctions on the IRGC, as you know, the United States has been doing for a long time, because of the IRGC's various activities, its hands in the Iranian ballistic missile program, its support for various terrorist groups in the region. And I think that that's actually more of a, you know, it doesn't have huge implications in practice. It's just a it's more muscle flexing than anything else. But if I may, I just want to push back against the idea that all of these activities, by the way, have been somehow have happened because of the nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to look at the regional situation as well, right? The nuclear negotiations were going on when the Middle East was already starting to descend into chaos after the Arab Spring, after the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the rise of ISIS. So the nuclear deal did not create all of the power vacuum, the failed and fragile states and terrorist organizations in the region. Iran has become active in some of these conflicts, it's because of its own security on the one hand, but also because it's taken advantage of what's going on in the region. It's not necessarily creating all of this from scratch,
right?
Thanks to the nuclear deal.
Jonathan, real quick, what is Congress likely to do?
Well, Congress is, first of all, they already instructed the president. I think this is an important point. The designation of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards was by instruction, but from a bipartisan Congress. So they have already asked the president to do that, and now mm-hmm. he's done it. On top of that, we're going to see a pressure campaign on Hezbollah, which is the terrorist proxy that Iran right. controls in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you're gonna see a debate for 60 days. How Congress responds,
right.
you know, it got me.
Well, thank you very, very much to our guests again, Jonathan Shanzer at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Kelsey Davenport at the Nonprofit Arms Control Association, and Ariane Tabatabai at the Harvard Kennedy School. Again, Laura Rosen and Al Monitor. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jamil Smith, in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.